BlizzCast, your official Blizzard podcast.
Welcome to BlizzCast Episode 7. This is Nathera from the World of Warcraft community team. And in this special wrap-up edition, we take a look at the second World of Warcraft expansion, Wrath of the Lich King. I'll be sitting down with our production director, J. Allen Brack, and lead game designer, Jeffrey Kaplan, to discuss it and get some insight on the development of this record-breaking expansion. Also in this episode, World of Warcraft community team member, Kriggle, sits down with our senior vice president of creative development, Chris Metzen, to discuss the lore of Wrath of the Lich King. Welcome to the BlizzCast, Jeff and Jay.
How's it going?
Thanks for having us.
Of all the possible expansions that could have come next, why was it important to do Wrath of the Lich King?
Well, I think we always wanted to go to Northrend when we were working on the original World of Warcraft game. We had development going on the Frozen Throne. So we were working on the RTS at the same time, and we were really inspired by the things going on in Northrend. When we wrapped up the development of World of Warcraft, we started talking next expansions and came up with a lot of ideas. And our two front runners were Outland and Northrend. And it wasn't a matter of favoring one over the other. It was more a matter of, you know, what's the right timing. So I think Lich King was probably very exciting to most of the team after the development of Burning Crusade. That was kind of our pushing it to the limits in terms of creativity and really testing the boundaries. And right. Lich King was kind of this coming home experience for a lot of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Northrend actually was one of the very first zones that was prototyped back in the original days. So one of the zones that eventually we ended up did making for this expansion was one of the first things that the team worked on.
Okay. So what was the most difficult decision that was made during the development process? You have all these ideas up in the air. What was it that made it so difficult?
I think it was difficult to narrow down from the, you know, 29 hero classes that we've got completed, which one we were going to go with.
Yeah, I think the class choice was super hard, and eventually we had it down to three front runners, which was pretty cool. We were talking for a while about a necromancer who would kind of be a ranged caster, do a lot of corpse explode, that sort of thing. Things we ended up incorporating in the Death Knight. We also had a cool idea for a rune master that was going to be more of a melee type, think rogue or monk type character, but Death Knight ultimately fit. I knew another hard decision that we had was what to do with the raiding game. And I think steering it towards the 10-25 person paradigm was a really tough decision, because you're kind of in theory craft land of, is this going to work? Is this the right thing for the game? And you just had to have faith that we were doing the right thing and that it was going to play out and be fun.
It seems like just the first month has really validated that decision. I mean, it's worked out really well. I think everyone's really, really excited about the 10-25 map.
Okay. So how many people were involved in the creation of the expansion? I mean, this is a pretty monumental expansion. It's added a lot of content. So what did it really take to put this all together?
We've got about 140 people that are on the development team proper, but that is kind of a small number of people that contribute to the overall kind of success of WoW and success of Lich King. But there's 140 developers, and that's just, you know, producers and artists and designers and programmers who are working on actual Lich King stuff. But of course, there's, you know, a huge QA team, there's a community team, customer service, shared technology teams, web team that is not part of.
An extension to that, how many worked just on the lore and the quests? With the increase in specifically story-driven quests, this seems to have been a monumental task all on its own.
Yeah, well, the quests and lore group did an amazing job. Obviously, the vision is spearheaded by Chris Metzen, who's our VP of Creative Development here and the creative director on the project. And then you have Alex Afrasiabi, who's our lead world designer, really pushing the design group forward that's responsible for the story and lore. And we have a group of five quest designers who are absolutely amazing. They all worked on Burning Crusade, so they all, you know, really know what they're doing at this point, or worked on the original game. And then we've also, in our creative development group, have writers there as well, who help us further flesh out the lore. So all told, it's a group of less than 10 people who were driving that storyline, but they're just so good at it. They've been doing it for so long, and they work well with each other. So I think that's why it all kind of came together.
I think, you know, we certainly had a renewed interest or a new focus on story, on really wanting to take the story to the next level after Burning Crusade. And yeah, those guys just did an amazing job in really bringing a lot of the story to the forefront and a lot of stuff that are really good elements that people can get behind. So yeah, it's really exciting to see, really exciting to play.
Excellent. What was one of the key elements that was learned from the Burning Crusade expansion that was important to the development of Wrath of the Lich King?
Don't dump the entire server into Hellfire Peninsula the second the expansion ships. That's
a good one.
That was a big one.
Yeah. I really, just kind of carrying in from the story question, I really like the decision to really push Arthas, or the, you know, in this case, the big bad guy, mm-hmm. much more in the face of the person who's even leveling up. You know, we spent so much time and have his great hero Illidan in Burning Crusade, but not that many people got to interact with him or got to see him. And I really appreciate the Arthas cameos that show up throughout the expansion. And of course, obviously the new Death Knight class and is all about your interaction with Arthas. So yeah, that to me is really exciting. Really, really big lesson.
We learned a lot of little lessons too. Itemization is greatly improved over what it was in Burning Crusade. And I think we can do even better. But an example is the heroic itemization. Players actually want to run heroics in Lich King. The items feel good. They're rewarding. And, you know, like I said, there's a few missteps here and there that we can do even better in the future. But showing that we're sort of watching the previous games, previous patches, and learning from our mistakes.
Mm-hmm. One of the newest technologies added to the game is phasing. It has added a whole new element and is most noticeable in the Death Knight starting area. How does this technology work, and how difficult was it to implement?
So one of the things that people always ask us about in terms of the world is they want to have a dynamic effect on it. They want to, if there's the village that's there full of bad guys, they want to be the hero who goes in and burns that village down and drives the bad guys away. But the problem with that theory is that an hour later, somebody else is going to log into the game, and they also want to be the hero and burn down the village, but someone else got to it before them. So
right.
While the idea of a dynamic world is really cool, the reality of the gameplay isn't always there. So what phasing basically is a tool that allows the designers and the engineers to orchestrate these experiences where somebody can feel like they have a great dynamic impact on Azeroth, when in reality they're not taking any content away from anybody.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's a great tool. I mean, if you've played on the Horde side where you actually get to experience the lockdown, the martial law of Orgrimmar, that's a very cool scene. And then for both factions, the retaking of Undercity is just a really, really neat thing. And then, you know, as you mentioned, the Death Knight starting experience is one of the best things I think we've ever done. It's very directed, very handheld kind of content delivery, and it just works really well.
And I know some people found it pretty surprising if they had never realized that was implemented in the game. They were kind of surprised.
Yeah, we didn't really talk too much about it, and really the people that experienced it a lot were obviously the people who were in the beta doing the Death Knight stuff and kind of wondering what's going on and how does this work. And, you know, you can see sometimes a little bit behind the curtain as to where we're making the changes, which is
right.
a little interesting, but yeah.
Yeah, I think our goal with it is to make it as seamless as possible, so really the players aren't aware that phasing is even going on. I mean, it's cool they've really honed in on it as almost a feature or you know, a new addition to the game. And, you know, certainly it's a new technology that we weren't using before, but I think our ultimate goal is that you just don't notice it happening, but man, is the world cool.
Yes.
Right.
Just a storytelling technique.
One of the areas that we use the phasing is with the Wrathgate, and that's a good example of an in-game cutscene as well. This hasn't been seen in World of Warcraft before. What was the catalyst for the idea to do this, and what do you feel it adds to the game?
Well, I think the catalyst to do it was that our quest team, along with Alex Afrasiabi and Chris Metzen, were jamming up the expansion overall story arc. And part of that was to have three main story moments that would define the three acts of the expansion. And the end of the first act is that cutscene at the Wrathgate. So obviously you're probably wondering, well, what are the other two acts? And that's what the patches are all about. But they really wanted to set the stage, and they wanted to do it in the most dramatic fashion possible. So that's where we got to talking about whether or not we could do an in-game cutscene. We can script a lot of things in the game engine and do a pretty cool job of it. But to really have a hand-tailored narrative experience like that, we had to go above and beyond and explore other avenues. So that's why we developed that little movie.
And, you know, there's a lot of things that, like, we've talked about doing this for a long time. You know, one of the things that people talk about wanting to see is you go into the dungeon and you hear maybe the main boss gives some kind of oration or gives you some kind of history as to why you're there and what's going on. And that runs into a lot of problems where, you know, this is my first time in the dungeon, but I'm with 24 other guys or 9 other guys who've seen it 100 times and really don't want to have to see it again. So it was also kind of, it worked really well in terms of it being part of the progress line, part of the quest progression, part of that storytelling thing where it could be a singular kind of experience that a player had and didn't really annoy anyone else. It was just an awesome, awesome epic experience.
Right. And they can go back and watch it again if they...
They can go back and watch it again. You can escape out of it if you don't want to see it at all. And the other thing that I think was really important with it is it was this epic storyline moment that you get at level 73 or 74.
Right.
So it wasn't something that only the end game, you know, most elite players are ever going to have access to and everybody else just has to watch it on YouTube. It's very accessible within the game and sort of everybody can have that awesome moment.
Right.
And having the achievement tie into that is really cool because you see people get the achievement in guild and you immediately know what they've experienced or are wondering what that is if you haven't experienced it yet yourself and kind of waiting for that moment.
Right, and I've noticed a lot of people, too, are looking specifically for that quest line just so that they can do it because they're looking forward to it so much.
Yeah.
What more do players have to look forward to in the future patches? In particular, what types of new encounters should they expect?
Well, one of the things that we've talked about a little bit that's on the horizon and players should be really excited about is Old War. So they've gotten to experience a little bit of Old War with Halls of Stone and Halls of Lightning, but we have an absolutely massive raid zone coming up, and it's going to serve both 10 and 25 person raid groups. So I think that's probably the most exciting thing on the very near horizon.
What is the one element of the expansion that you're most proud of?
You know, I think introducing the new class into WoW was super challenging. It worked out just really awesome in just every possible way. I think the class is awesome. The dynamics are awesome. The actual gameplay is very cool. The new rune resource mechanic is great. The starting experience and the content from which you create your hero class all the way up to the moment where you're in the world kind of on your own, I think is absolutely incredible. So just that whole, 2 to 3 levels that you play is just a great, great, fantastic thing. I love it.
Jeff agrees.
It's really hard not to give a corny answer because...
Mr. Corny right here.
I don't think Jay's answer was anything but corny. But what I was going to say is it's sort of the way the whole expansion comes together and works with itself. I feel like the zones and the quests tie together so nicely in this expansion. The hub city, Dalaran, ties in with the rest of the expansion extremely well and is much better designed and looks more beautiful than any other city we've built previously. And then the way that the content flows from the questing level up experience right into the dungeons and heroics and then naturally segues players into raiding. It's just a nice experience how overall tied together everything is. But I know that's not a singular element or whatever. But
yeah, I echo those things. I think it's fantastic and it's got a lot of lessons. The zones, I think, are obviously great and fantastic and just some of the best stuff we've done as well on that front. And the verticality of zones, particularly in Howling Fjord, is just really great as well.
So now that the encounter with Arthas is inevitable, does this mean Wrath of the
Lich? Are what? Who?
So now that the encounter with Arthas is inevitable, does this mean Wrath of the Lich King is the end of the road?
Well, certainly not. I mean, Arthas is just one bad guy. A lot of people will really get upset with us when we talk about Wrath of the Lich King and the fact that you're going to have a chance to encounter Arthas. And they'll say, how could you kill Arthas? He's what Warcraft was built on.
Right.
But that really is a recent view of things. A lot of people don't realize that Arthas was mainly developed in Warcraft 3, which was the game right before WoW. And there were many Warcrafts before that and expansions to those RTS games where we introduced new villains and we killed them off and introduced new heroes and killed them off. So I feel like Arthas is awesome. He's one of our greatest bad guys, but you know, we can come up with a lot of great bad guys for you to fight. There's already a lot of villains out there in the WoW lore or the Warcraft lore that people haven't even encountered or want to know, you know, what's going on with that. I mean, if you look at Onyxia and Nefarian, they're just the son and daughter of a really bad guy that nobody's encountered yet. So,
right, they've heard about him, but they haven't seen him yet.
There's a lot of bad guys out there for the players to fight still.
I think we also just have a lot of stories that we still want to tell. You know, we just finished the Burning Crusade expansion, but we haven't met the boss of the Burning Legion yet. Sargeras is still out there. Mm-hmm. What's going on with him? What is he doing? I'm certain that he's not done. Right. So yeah, there's a lot of guys out there.
Plus, we're notorious for killing everybody off, and then they come back.
And then later. They come back.
Yeah, we're big fans of that.
And then you get to kill them again.
The real goal is, throughout the Warcraft games, how many times can you kill Mal'Ganis? Right? So we're doing a pretty good job so far.
Nice. Okay, well, I think that wraps everything up. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
Cool. Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.
Up next, we have The Story So Far with community team member Kriggle with Senior Vice President of Creative Development, Chris Metzen.
BlizzCast, your official Blizzard podcast.
Hello, everyone. This is Kriggle. Welcome to The Story So Far. We have our special guest, Senior Vice President of Creative Development, Chris Metzen.
Hello.
Hello, sir. So we have a few questions for you today.
Mm-hmm.
With so much of the focus on Outland last year, what's been going on in Azeroth?
Wow. Yeah, all sorts of stuff. By now, everyone playing Wrath of the Lich King have pretty much seen like any number of events unfolding in, you know, the world of Azeroth specifically. One notable bit would be, you know, the return of King Varian from his sojourn as a gladiator, as chronicled in the comic series we've been putting out with Wildstorm. So that's come off pretty cool. We've been very pleased about all that and his kind of new arrival on the scene. Heralds a lot of things. You know, we're trying to, over time, re-engage the engines of hate and violence between the Alliance and Horde. It's been argued by some for the past couple years that, you know, under Thrall's leadership, the Horde has kind of had its teeth pulled a little bit since he's much more, I guess I wouldn't say a man of peace, but very far-sighted. Thrall tries to stay away from kind of petty conflicts and really focus on what's going to be best for his people. And like I said, it's been argued by some that it has, you know, decreased the sense that, you know, the Horde is a very dangerous entity when riled. So we figured, you know, to kind of stir that pot, it'd be interesting to reconstruct an Alliance hero that could come packing, you know, and really have a view of the orcs and the Horde that is very dangerous. So Varian could prove to do some very interesting things over the hall in terms of escalating the tension between the Alliance and the Horde. So we've had that going on. What else? Obviously, the Lich King's been turning up the heat in anticipation of Wrath of the Lich King. You know, we had the Undead Plague roll out and, you know, that whole event played out and just kind of, you know, further illustrated that, you know, the sense of scale and conflict is still very real with the undead. And as that all rolled into Wrath of the Lich King, I think it worked really well as an experiment, as a world event, and as a fictional event, you know, just to show how much at stake there is if the undead should ever really, you know, plague the world. other than that, I don't know. I mean, there's all sorts of little stories popping, you know, on what we've started to call terrestrial Azeroth. I think the events of Wrath of the Lich King really show all sorts of stuff. Just the both factions really mobilizing their forces, you know, heading to the north. The Kirin Tor, you know, teleporting Dalaran up above Northrend. I mean, these are pretty big events. You know, as the armies move north and attempt to engage the Lich King, and I think that's occupied a lot of the happenings on Azeroth specifically during the end events of the Burning Crusade.
Outstanding. So how have the happenings in Outland and the apparent death of Illidan actually affected Azeroth as a whole?
That's a good question. The death of Illidan, it's kind of hard to say. I think players of Wrath of the Lich King right now can see that we've made a concerted effort to make the villain more foreground this time. We wanted to put Arthas in your path repeatedly and really make him feel like a personal villain, you know, like you have a personal stake in his demise. We wanted to ramp up the tension with both factions and show that while we may yet defeat the Lich King in subsequent patches, but that we're all going to lose a little bit of ourselves up there in the snow, and that the general war against the Scourge has cost us something, right? And as you have, you know, leaders like Thrall and Varian, and you have, upstart, you know, personalities like Garrosh Hellscream really agitating things, we see that the fight against the Lich King will be very costly for both sides, right? It's kind of a theme that we're very interested in these days. And so in having said all that, when we look back on Burning Crusade, I think one of the lessons learned was that Illidan didn't feel very personal, right? You didn't get to meet him multiple times. There were a couple bits in, I think, Shadowmoon Valley where he would make an appearance with a comma and those scenes that played out. But we really didn't feel in looking back that he was evident enough. And so when you say, well, you know, we've defeated Illidan, and you can argue at some logistical level that with Outland degrees safer, the universe in general is safer from the Burning Crusade. Azeroth specifically is safer from the Burning Legion. But, you know, if I was just a general citizen on Azeroth, would I feel that? You know, would I really understand what was won in Outland? Maybe not. And in saying that, that was part of our reason to try and make the war against the Lich King feel a lot more in your face and a lot more vital.
Outstanding. Once again.
I may have over-answered that, but...
No, I think you did well.
Thank you.
With Northrend opened, and expeditions taking place right now, how have the events of the past led inexorably toward this end?
How to answer that safely, I guess it would be what points in the past you're talking about. I think there's a number of historical events that have led to this current conflict in Northrend, some of which are kind of widely known to players and some of which are not, and their plot lines. But I think that we plan on, moving forward with, slowly and surely as the subsequent event patches roll out for Lich King. Certainly, you know, the creation of the Lich King, you know, by Kil'jaeden, you know, as a part of the machinations of the Burning Legion, resulted in, you know, the corruption of Prince Arthas, who should have been humanity's best and brightest. I think that story is played out in, Warcraft 3 and the Frozen Throne, really had a lot of equity with our fans at the time. And so I think that the whole story of Arthas, his fall from grace, and the kind of inevitable want to bring him to justice and put him down for all the things he's done, was something that a lot of fans wanted to see. And I think that is a particular part of this expansion set's character. I mean, obviously it's central to the plot, but I think there's an emotional undercurrent about Arthas as a villain that is something we haven't seen in Warcraft in a while. And I think it's particularly cool for fans, you know, that have been familiar with the setting before to, you know, be able to take part in the events of Warcraft 3 and really get in Arthas's face and bring some resolution to that whole chain of events. So apart from all that, there's a whole other aspect to the story of Lich King, which is the Yogg-Saron, plot line, you know, where we're suggesting that there's a certain old god component that really moves as a major undercurrent of a lot of the Warcraft continuity. You know, just how is Yogg-Saron, you know, tied to the Scourge or to the Lich King specifically? I won't tell you at this point, but you know, it's definitely a major hook that we're driving forward. You know, whatever the old god storyline is, it definitely is not going to end in Northrend, right? It's a global threat, and really plays to the much broader context of what the Warcraft conflict really is. So I guess you could say there's a lot of things rooted in the past that have necessitated this conflict at this time. You know, as we see the Alliance and the Horde rushing to, you know, fight the big bad guy. And you can argue that the little bits of their soul, the little bits of their sanity that they'll leave up there in the snow, you know, even if they achieve victory, might be part of a larger machination as well, you know. Is something wearing our heroes down? You know, it's kind of an interesting theme.
Entropy.
Yeah.
Excellent answer once again, sir.
Thank you. I've been practicing.
Oh, well, you've done a good job. With all this going on, how have the Dragonflights been dealing with the threat of Arthas? Have they been continuing to see him as a threat? Is this something new and interesting to them?
Right. I think as played out, at this point, I think, you know, a lot of our players have pounded through a good portion of the Lich King content. So, you know, I guess it isn't really spoiling anything to say that, you know, the Dragonflights have been somewhat distracted lately. You know, they're also under siege. I guess it wouldn't hurt to illustrate that, you know, someone came along and, you know, created this nightmare scenario within the Emerald Dream, you know, and effectively, you know, really putting a serious distraction on Ysera and the Green Dragonflight. Someone came along and put a zap on Nos Dormu, you know, who, you know, has been absent for a few years in the continuity, as evidenced in the Caverns of Time scenarios. You know, so the Bronze Dragonflight is also very, you know, befuddled and distracted in this current age. The Black Dragonflight, you know, for, you know, about 10,000 years now has been, you could argue, distracted. You know, it has veered from its pure purpose in defending the Earth, essentially. Not too long after that, the Blue Dragonflight got super distracted. You know, the Malygos kind of lost his mind there for a while. So you could argue that, are these random events, or is there some unforeseen, you know, force at work trying to destabilize and or bring ruin upon, you know, the five dragonflights that were, you know, originally empowered to protect this world. And as we see all those tensions play out, you know, and certainly as Malygos got his wits about him, you could argue, and decided to, you know, begin his great Nexus War on magic, you know, we see the dragonflights at each other's throats, you know, through all the Wormrest Temple quests in the middle of Dragonblight. I think we've done a pretty good job of drawing players into that conflict, into the world of the dragons, to see how their relationships are playing out, to get a sense of what Alexstrasza thinks of these times and these events playing out. So they've already got a lot of conflicts brewing before, you know, the whole subject of Arthas even comes up. And you might wonder, well, that seems very timely. So again, you know, are all these things connected in some grand, vast conspiracy? You know, perhaps, you know, that would seem to make sense at this point. But again, those are questions that we'll kind of explore a little further down the road.
Look forward to seeing more of the Dragonflights.
I do too.
Yeah. So Medivh, he showed up right in the nick of time, I guess you could say, in the last true time of peril for the world. Is there any chance we'll get to see him again soon?
Medivh. Yeah. He's had two good runs, you know, at life. Interesting story with Medivh. But I think that, you know, with his first leg of his career being largely unsuccessful, right? You know, as he was corrupted and, you know, used by the Legion to open the portal and, you know, thus really bring about the great conflict of the modern era. War III allowed him the chance to kind of reconstitute himself and in some form or another make amends for the mess he had made, you know, by rallying, acting as this kind of Gandalf-like prophet and rallying, you know, the various leaders of the Alliance and the Horde to stand against the Legion for that, you know, great battle at the top of Mount Hyjal. And I think just as a story dude, we've probably played him out, you know, bringing him back too many times, you know, could start to feel a little X-Men-ish. And I love me some X-Men, but, you know, I don't want to get into the whole Phoenix thing where about every 8 years we bring him back. And
the Professor.
Or the Professor. And there's more. but having said that, I do think there's a lot of equity in the legacy of the Order of Tirisfal, the legacy of the guardian concept, you know, the singular empowered warrior against, you know, the forces of darkness, you know, roaming the earth like Cain. I think there's a lot of equity there, and I definitely feel, hint, that may be a track, you know, a plot line or, you know, a track of ideas that we are likely to get into at some future point. I just think there's a lot of really cool pepper there. And we've had a number of discussions about what the Order of Tirisfal really was back in the day, how it worked, how these, you know, very disparate people imparted their powers onto a singular champion. And I think there's a lot of, you know, really good hooks there. But the question would be, with the Burning Legion essentially stymied for the time being in Outland and on terrestrial Azeroth, what kind of guardian does the world need now? That's actually the cool hook that I think we're very interested in pursuing. And could the guardian take a different shape this time? You know, what the world needed most back in the day, you know, it turned out to be some dude, you know, from the kingdom of Stormwind and, you know, thus empowered. But how interesting if the guardian didn't come from the human line, if it should arise again. So that's very fertile ground.
Sounds like a lot of room for plot hooks right there.
Indeed.
Let's go back to Varian's appearance here. Mm-hmm. With Varian appearing, how has the relationship between Thrall and Jaina persevered? Does she feel a lot of political pressure to stop making peace overtures?
Right. I don't know how much is like all, you know, spoiler alert, you know, but that scenario definitely plays out, in Lich King, where we see the Wrathgate event. You know, we see that the Forsaken have been, or certain elements of the Forsaken, like, you know, Putras and Verimothras have hatched a plan that they've had for, you know, quite a while now, to develop this super plague, right, that will just destroy everybody. And at the Wrathgate event, as part of Lich King, we see them finally enact, you know, their plan and unleash their super plague. And this event really creates a lot of tension between the Alliance and the Horde, and within the Horde itself. You know, it was kind of questionable to even take the Forsaken in, you know, many years ago and make them part of the Horde because of potentialities just like this. And to guys like Varian, he looks at this instance as, well, hey, what'd you think was going to happen, you know? These guys are evil scum. You know, of course they, you know, dropped a plague on top of everybody. So it doesn't help Varian's view of the Horde. And even though you can likely prove that, well, hey, the orcs had nothing to do with it. You know, this didn't happen. You know, Thrall didn't rubber stamp this event. But it just goes to show that the Horde is a very dangerous assortment of savage races, you know, as seen through the eyes of Varian. And hey, Thrall, if you can't keep control of all these bruisers, right, then I'm going to do something about it. You know, I think that's what Varian believes. And we see that play out, his very specific thinking towards all these events plays out in the Undercity quest component, where we see him at the end actually giving Thrall a piece of his mind. I think they actually come to blows as well. I played it the other night. It was pretty cool. So where young Jaina comes into play, you know, I think she's always tried to toe the line and, you know, try and keep channels open with Thrall specifically, so that, you know, that area of Eastern Kalimdor didn't just plunge into madness, right? You know, you would have Theramore and Durotar, you know, just going at it a lot more aggressively if the two of them, you know, had not kind of made this pact to try and contain, you know, the racial hatred that is always, you know, underlying, you know, the interactions of humans and orcs. And so what the Wrathgate event and the subsequent liberation of Undercity does is just really ratchets up the hate and mistrust and misunderstanding. I don't think Jane is going to really have any legs to stand on in terms of trying to keep the peace, or I don't think Jane is going to have a lot of success in negotiating any peace accords anytime soon. And I'm sure it's very heartbreaking to her, because she knows Thrall and she knows what drives him, and she knows essentially he's a very noble guy, and he's watching as, you know, things are playing out that are really starting to tear away at the stability of the Horde, and that's terrifying to him. And we shall see what he does.
So maybe look for some interesting stuff from Thrall soon.
Tidal waves of it.
Tidal waves, excellent.
I don't mean any specific pun about that either.
Let's shift gears a bit, and let's take things to some of the cool newer players, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
The Ebon Order, definitely very exciting, very new, very cool. How long has it been around? Where's it been in Azeroth?
Order of the Ebon Blade. Like obviously we made this thing up recently. The origins of the Order really kind of get their start with the this sounds like a plug, but the Ashbringer comic series Mickey Nielsen's currently writing for Wildstorm really is the origin of, in a roundabout way, it's the origin of the Death Knights, certainly the origin of the Sword and the Mograine family and the Ashbringer legacy. But I think all of that really rolls one-to-one into the creation of this current Order of Death Knights. Who, you know, Darian Mograine is the chief of. And really, I think the origin of the group plays out in the Death Knight starting area, you know, as you kind of get your start as a Death Knight and, you know, you're on the Lich King's payroll, and then ultimately the intervention at Light's Hope Chapel of, you know, Tyrion Fordring really allows the Death Knights to kind of win their freedom, you know, and while they are still very dark, you know, and wielding very dark powers, at least they're not on the Lich King payroll and they're out to kind of make him pay. So I think in a lot of ways, you know, the Order of the Ebon Blade, we're still kind of talking about how it will play out longer term in the world, you know, like post Lich King. As we deal with Arthas and as we put him down and dispense that justice, you know, what happens in Northrend after that? You know, what is the ultimate fate of the Lich King? And then ultimately, what is the fate of this order of very dark anti-heroes, you know, when they've completed their mission? You know, what do they do now? You can never go home again. You know, and eternity is a very long time if you're one of these cats. So I think that's definitely a question we're still discussing and working through. You know, I think, you know, we've got some pretty cool hooks for the Order of the Old Ebon Blade. You know, potentially how they play well with, you know, the Order of the Silver Hand and, you know, the Paladins and the Argent Crusade. But I think a lot of that is still not up in the air, but, you know, still being discussed.
Very cool. So I look forward to seeing a lot more about the Order of the Ebon Blade and the Death Knights in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, sir. It was great doing this wonderful segment with you.
Thank you.
That wraps up this edition of BlizzCast. This was Kriggle, and we'll see you again next time on BlizzCast.
BlizzCast. Your official Blizzard podcast.